It's my distinct pleasure to welcome you and to introduce Stuart Soroka. Stuart, I first started to get to know Stuart's work over the last couple of years, not because he's only been doing work the last couple of years, but because I have only shifted back into the academic mainstream. And I've been very impressed with the character and quality of the work he's done, and it took me back to my years as an undergraduate when... and that was a long time ago. It was at a time when there was a theory of the democratic elitism was very much making the rounds, and people in academia were convinced that that democracy is really operated by elites, and that really something should be done about that. That elite opinion drove everything. The public was very much an afterthought, if it was a thought at all. That perspective on democracy has survived in many ways. It has to have been changed, of course, over the years. But I think the work Stuart and his colleagues have been doing have really forced us to take a long, hard look at the relationship between public opinion and public policy. And in fact, it was Stuart's work that inspired us to actually create this little series of speakers devoted to that very topic about the ways in which public opinion or the public could be engaged in the creation of public policy. Stuart, I think if you've taken a look at this, his brief bio, know that Stuart is the associate professor at the moment at McGill University. He's also a William Dawson Scholar, and he's in the Department of Political Science. He's a member of the Center for the Study of Democratic Citizenship, and is in a previous life was the past director of the Canadian Opinion Research Archive. He's also a co-investigator with the Canadian Election Studies, and his current research focuses on political behavior, psychology, communication, and policy. We're really pleased. Stuart's come to us not from McGill today, but from Florence. So he's made a big trip to be with us today. And on behalf of colleagues at the University of Regina and here, the University of Saskatchewan, welcome.
Thank you very much for those kind words. You've included a good excuse for if I start dozing in the middle of the talk, you'll know why. I'm still getting over some jet lag. I should be okay, though. I apologize to people not in this room who will think that intermittently I stare off into space. It's because my presentation is right there, and intermittently I'm going to look at it. What I want to try to do today is give a mostly theoretical talk. I want to make a pitch for the value in using public opinion data for policy development, for policy analysis, and moreover for understanding the nature, quality, the functioning of representative democratic institutions. I'm going to do all that, and I'll just kind of ramble on about that a little bit. My expectation is that in questions we'll get, I hope, to some more kind of applied discussion. But I'm going to start kind of at 30,000 feet and make an argument for how I think democracies should work, the kind of servo mechanism that I think representative democracies should be, where public opinion fits into that, the consequent kind of central role that public opinion has in democracy and in policy development, and then I'm going to argue that we see evidence of this in the way in which policy works, not just in Canada, but across countries. And I'm going to draw a fair bit on a recent book I wrote with Christopher Valasian, and I'm going to draw a little bit on some other papers that Chris and I have just written. So with that, here we go. Outline of the talk is roughly as follows. I want to talk briefly about aggregate rationality. This is the kind of, the standard now in the literature in which I work pitch for the fact that public opinion is not just noise, there is some content there, and this is the kind of necessary precursor to then worrying about using public opinion for something. So I'm going to say, well, there's something in public opinion. At least in the aggregate, there's something in public opinion. Then I'm going to talk for a fair bit until everyone is bored about the thermostatic model of opinion-policy relationships. I'm going to talk about weighing dynamic representation, which is about the thermostatic model which is what the thermostatic model focuses on, with partisan representation. I'm going to look at some institutional variance, and then I'm going to just make some quick notes about how I think the kind of decline in public opinion polling on all issues, but policy issues included in Canada, is potentially problematic, given if you buy everything I say before that. So let's get started. But the argument for aggregate rationality goes something like this. At the individual level, there people make all kinds of errors, right? So anyone who's been engaged in public opinion polling knows that people give some crazy answers to questions. Not everybody knows everything about everything. And you can ask people questions, and you'll get answers to those questions, but sometimes those answers are nonsense or just misinformed. So if what you want to do is have any one random person guide a representative democracy, you're going to have problems. But of course, we don't have any one random person make all the decisions in a democracy. We make these decisions in the aggregate, or at least public opinion, make decisions so much as provide the kind of input into decision making, and public opinion is necessarily aggregate. So the kind of standard assumption is, well, there's all kinds of individual level error, and in some magical way, that individual error cancels out in the aggregate. And there are actually several different ways in which that may or may not work, and there's a whole debate on whether that's true or not. I'm going to argue that for our purposes today, aggregate opinion seems to be both stable and rational. Rational in the sense that it seems to react over time to aggregate level trends. And I'm just flashing up, this is a healthcare policy mood measure. It's just a measure of attitudes about healthcare policy, basically confidence in the Canadian healthcare system. It's extracted from a bunch of different data series. I'm using it here just to demonstrate that there is a kind of stability over time, right? It's not just noise. Public opinion doesn't just bounce back and forth. It seems to move kind of systematically. There's some stability to it, but also there's some systematic movement. You have a slow decline in confidence in the healthcare system leading up to the Romano Report, and then you have a steady increase since the period of the Romano Report. Now, those of you in healthcare, we might talk about what accounts exactly for that steady increase. And they argue there shouldn't be that steady increase. And of course, this isn't driven just by policy. It can be driven by media content and any number of other things. The point is that it's driven by this stuff systematically. There is a kind of slow and steady movement over time, and that slow is roughly as we might expect, given all the exogenous things that are partly exogenous things that are feeding into public opinion. And so that's the background. The public opinion seems to demonstrate across a wide range of policy domains a kind of systematic aggregate rationality. Thus, we can start thinking about how to use public opinion in public policy. If when I did this, it just all ended up big, messy noise, bouncing back and forth, we couldn't figure out why one direction, why I'm moving the other direction. Any one year it could be up, it would be down. We would have good reason to start thinking, well, maybe using this public opinion thing in policy is not such a good plan. And I'm saying, it's not a bad plan. And that's good news, right? So we can start with the idea that public opinion can be a kind of useful resource in making policy, in evaluating policy, in understanding the functioning of democratic institutions, and now I'm going to argue, in fact, we should see the relationship between public opinion and policy as being thermostatic. Thermostatic in the following way. When you want the room to be hotter, you turn up the thermostat. The thermostat starts providing heat, or asks the furnace, at least, to start providing heat. The furnace starts providing heat. And at the point at which the room has reached the temperature you wanted it to reach, the thermostat tells the furnace to turn off. There is a negative feedback loop, right? The thermostat is looking at the gap between what you want and where things are, and it tries to narrow that gap, and it's constantly monitoring that gap. And when you get what you want, you don't still want more of it. That is, when the thermostat gets enough heat, it doesn't continue to want more and more heat. That's basically the same kind of mechanism that democracy is. And this is not a new idea, this kind of view of democracy as a servo mechanism. It comes out of like Norbert Wiener's work on cybernetics, which actually comes from its math that came out of designing self-guided missiles. But the kind of the work that came out of cybernetics and then informed work by, among others, David Easton and Carl Deutsch and these kind of early functionalist models of political science, that's about as complicated it's actually only the second most complicated. Carl Deutsch's figure is even worse. Figure of how a democracy might work. Basically, a democracy might work like this. You have some public opinion over here on this side. That public opinion gets fed into some box. It comes out as policy. And then that policy then feeds back on public opinion. That is, there has to be some kind of feedback loop. This year, we want government to spend a lot more on healthcare. If our government spends a lot more on healthcare, our preferences for change should be revised downward. If we want $10,000 this year and the government gives us $5,000, then next year, ceteris paribus, holding everything else constant, we should now want only $5,000 more. Holding everything else constant. Of course, there are lots of other things moving at the same time. We never can't really ever see that relationship in quite that simple a way. But we can look at democracy as this kind of a servo mechanism. Essentially like a thermostat. Imagine this, you have this distribution of opinion at any given point in time, and it's like a very, I've just used very, very loose labels here. And you have distribution of opinion, you've got some people that want less policy, and you've got some people that want more policy. And in the middle here we have P star, that's where we would like policy to be. That's our preferred level of policy is P star. It's in the middle of the distribution, right? So there's this distribution of opinion in the middle of the distribution, and aggregate public wants policy to be at P star. But policy isn't at P star, policy is at P. There right now is less policy than we would like there to be. And so our relative preference for change, R, sub T, which is at a given point in time, our relative preference for change is that big, right? Is the gap between the two dotted lines. In the next year, let's say policy moves. Let's say government is responsive, and so policy moves. So now we have policy at T plus one. Policy has moved in the direction we wanted it to move. Okay, that's good news that the politician's doing their job. That's policy moving in the way in which we expect it to move in a democracy. What we need, though, is not just for policy to move where we want it to be. We need, in order to, as policymakers, start using public opinion as something that's useful, we need public opinion to react to that policy change. We need relative preferences for change to shrink. So R at time plus one is smaller than R at T. That's the feedback loop. That's critical to using public opinion as an input to public policy. We need, in order for representative democracy to work, we need institutions that help turn public preferences into public policy. But just as importantly, we need informed public preferences. Public preferences that are informed in the aggregate world, where that world includes what policy has been doing. It's like the Ontario Science Centre has one of those phones, you know, where you have to say the alphabet and it gives you the alphabet with a delay and you... This is a nice figure for that too, actually. So note that the relationship I'm describing isn't all simultaneous. It kind of spills out over time, and that's important for the econometricians in the room. I mean, in terms of estimating this, it's actually a relatively simple set of autoregressive distributed lag models, right? Where at any given point, we have relative preferences for policy change, that's the R, affecting policy in the subsequent year. And then that policy feeds back into preferences directly, into relative preferences directly, and relative preferences affects policy the next year, and so on and so on and so on. We experience policy immediately, and we experience policy concurrently, let's say, and that changes our preferences for policy. But our preferences for policy don't immediately turn into policy because the policy takes a year to make. So it's over the course of the budgetary cycle, and then the actual spending part of that, that our preferences gradually turn into policy. And there's some quite interesting discussion to be had about how long that takes, right? I mean, some policy happens immediately, some policy takes actually a very long time, and it's, I think, interesting to think about whether what we react to, whether what the public reacts to are policy decisions, which is to say, let's say, appropriations, versus whether what we react to are outlays, the actual spending of that thing. The kind of classic example is, if we want our government to build a giant aircraft carrier, what do we react to? The decision to build that giant aircraft carrier, or the successful completion of the aircraft carrier, which is 15 years from now? I think that's an interesting policy question. I don't have the answer. answer to that, though I sort of have an answer to that. Our suspicion is that we react to the decision more than we react to the actual spending. Note that I don't believe that we're all magically omnipotent and know everything about everything. The thermostatic model does not actually require a lot of public opinion. First, we don't have to have absolute preferences for policy. And in fact, though pollsters sometimes ask questions about absolute preferences, those questions are, for the most part, a little bit silly. We don't know enough about policy to know absolutely that we want this level of healthcare spending. That's a nice example, because a pollster would never say, how much do you think the federal government should spend on healthcare next year? We can't answer that. We have the faintest idea. In fact, when it's healthcare, the federal government doesn't know how much the federal government spends on healthcare. And because Stats Canada doesn't count that anymore, not even they know what the federal government spends on. We haven't had that at the end. So we don't ask questions like that, but we do ask questions like, do you think the federal government should spend more, spend less, or spend the same on healthcare? And we only sort of mean spending when we ask that question. It kind of means, do you think they should do more, there should be more or less of healthcare from the federal government next year? And it doesn't take much to have an opinion on that. That's a relatively easy opinion to have. You have a sense for what you're getting in healthcare, and whether, ignoring whether you want it from the federal government or the provincial government, but you have a sense for what is going on in healthcare, and you can say they should be doing more about that, or they should be doing less about that. That's a relative preference, right? Relative to actual existing levels of healthcare. And that's a much simpler opinion to have than the kind of complex opinions about absolute preferences that, of course, policymakers have to have. We don't require that they have clearly defined positions on issues. You don't have to know exactly where you want the money spent on healthcare. You want some of it to go to this, and we don't need that for opinion to be useful. And in fact, when we ask questions like that, what we get is mostly noise. We need to ask the kinds of questions that people are able to answer and use opinion, at the right level in order to inform policy. We can ask these big general questions. They can be actually very informative about policy. And we don't actually require that everybody pays attention to all policies. Keep in mind that aggregate trends don't have to be driven by everybody changing their mind all the time. Aggregate trends can be driven by just some people changing their mind. So we could have some people who fluctuate randomly, some people who are totally stable in their opinions, and then some people who are hyper-attentive to healthcare policy. And those people who are hyper-attentive to healthcare policy are moving the aggregate trend. We don't know exactly who those people are, but they're in there and they're moving the aggregate trend. And some of those people who care about healthcare policy also care about environmental policy. And then there are some people who care all about healthcare policy, but they care a lot about environmental policy. So there is an issue public for healthcare policy, and maybe overlapping issue public for environment policy, and so on and so on and so on and so on. And so it may actually be through a process of issue publics, essentially, that we get a kind of aggregate rationality across a whole range of policy issues. Not all policy issues. Some policy issues are just not salient, and there is no issue public for them. Until recently, I used to use transportation as an example of a domain in which most people didn't have preferences, and we wouldn't see aggregate rationality in transportation policy, but I live in Quebec. We have aggregate level rationality on transportation policy. When you live in a city where bridges might actually fall on you, and do with some regularity, it's a salient issue domain. These are the equations for those of you who want to see them. Everything I talk about that is results-based at this stage is based on the estimation of two relatively simple models. And I'm not going to talk about them in too much detail, except to note that what we're talking about on the one hand is a feedback model where relative preferences at a given time are a function of policy at that time, and what is here W, which is a set of other factors, a set of other exogenous factors. For the most part, we're talking about macroeconomics that also affects preferences for policy. And then we have this policy representation model. Changes in public preferences as a consequence of relative preferences for policy, whether we want change or whether we don't want change. And then G, another set of variables, which is for the most part partisanship of government. Note that we expect a positive relationship where representation is concerned. If we want more, the government should provide us more. And we expect a negative relationship in the other case. When government provides us more, we should then not still want that more. Ceteris paribus, holding everything else constant. So we're really looking at the magnitude of two coefficients. one coefficient that captures representation, one coefficient that captures feedback, and looking for whether there's any kind of, in this case, systematic variance in the magnitude of those coefficients as we look from one policy domain to the other. While we're doing that, let's keep in mind in the background that everything I'm going to focus on is about dynamic, essentially, representation. Right? There isn't much space for parties in the story that I've just told. Right? You just have governments, and these governments are reacting to preferences, and they're reacting to preferences on an annual basis independent of elections. That, of course, is not how everything works, at least not how all representation works. We might think about representation happening in two different ways, a kind of direct impact, which is I elect a government, and that government then does what I ask them to do, which is only a barely accurate description of how elections work. But nevertheless, I elect a conservative government. I expect them to move policy to the right, let's say. And then that's the direct effect. And then there's the indirect effect. Once they are in government, I expect them to react to my preferences over time as well. We expect both these things. And so what you might have is preferences. This is the dark line that's moving. I mean, this is an invented line, but it's kind of moving over time. And then you have a representation which looks like that dotted line, which is moving with preferences between elections, and then you have an election, and it shifts. In this case, maybe it shifts rightward when the partisanship changes, and then you have dynamic representation, and then it shifts leftward, and then you have dynamic representation. So you have some combination of direct and indirect representation, and I don't know what the right balance is. I know that we don't want just one of them. We don't want a situation where actually there's very little movement over time and there's massive partisan shifts. Right? That creates very noisy policy. Right? That creates policy that, at least in this picture, is regularly far away from preferences. Right? We elect a left government. That government moves so far to the left that they're way more left than we ever wanted them to be. So we elect a right government. That government moves so far to the right. We don't want that. We also don't really want this. I kind of feel like this is what we have in Quebec right now. It doesn't really matter which party we elect. They're basically going to do the same thing. So you can use elections to penalize a government because they've been in government too long, but there isn't much, there's no partisan effect on policy, except in language. Here we have very, very small partisan effects, but lots of dynamic representation. We want some combination of the two things. And so one of the things we need to be doing when we're setting up political institutions, when we're thinking about partisanship, when we're complaining about too much partisanship or too little partisanship, where we're setting up kind of how a policy domain works and what that policy network is going to be and how that's going to work, one of the things we need to be thinking about is whether what we want are partisan effects or not partisan effects. Whether what we want is just for policy, for parties to essentially be managers, or we want more than that. That is, we want some partisanship too. But the partisanship component is not really what I'm talking about here. I'm talking mostly about the dynamic part today, and where the dynamic part is concerned, I'm going to skip over the part where I try to prove to you that policy responds to preferences and that preferences respond to policy. I'm just going to say they do. Take my word for it. When people want more spending in a salient domain across a whole range of countries, but particularly in the countries that we've studied the most, Anglo-American democracies, when people want more spending, governments tend to provide more spending. And when governments provide that more spending, people tend to respond thermostatically. And this is true across half a dozen domains across these three countries over large periods of time. But there's variance. It doesn't work the same in every single policy domain. We have at least three expectations. In more salient policy domains, there should be more representation and more feedback. There should be more feedback because people are, I mean, it's kind of, this is a circular definition, but it's a salient policy domain. People should be paying attention to it. They should be responding to it more. Because people are responding to it more, there should be a greater incentive for representation because you can be rewarded or penalized for doing something in that policy domain because people are paying attention to it. So we should see more in salient domains than in non-salient domains. We should see less public responsiveness in federal situations. See, I'm working my way towards a Canada story here. Public responsiveness, which is critical to representation, you need there to be feedback, you need the public to be responding in order to create an incentive for representation. Public responsiveness is going to be weak when the policy signal is less clear. I haven't the faintest idea which government is responsible for increases or decreases in healthcare spending? I really don't know. And I wrote a bunch of reports on healthcare. I haven't the faintest idea. And actually, when you go to those conferences with healthcare policymakers, it seems pretty clear to me they don't really know either. This is a policy domain, not just where both governments are spending simultaneously, but where the federal funding is coming through, in some cases, block transfers that aren't clearly healthcare. We just can't tell. And these are people who study policy. So now you go to the public and you say, do you think the government should do more or less? Should they spend more or spend less on healthcare spending? Faintest idea. In fact, there are a fair number of Canadians who don't know who exactly is responsible for healthcare. And I mean, who could blame them? Federalism produces a lack of clarity in the policy signal. As a consequence, it should produce reduced responsiveness and, as a consequence, less representation. There is a cost to federalism. There are several costs. That is one of them. Third, policy representation should be weaker in parliamentary systems. The executive in a parliamentary system is not directly elected, is isolated from public opinion. They don't pay costs the way directly elected executives do. And as a consequence, there's less incentive for representation. Moreover, there isn't the same system of checks and balances in the parliamentary system as there is in a presidential system. Now, we all watch American politics and roll our eyes because nothing's getting done and they're all fighting, right? But all that fighting is about error correction. Right, is making it very, very difficult for governments to make wrong decisions. Think of it that way. You have, on the one hand, an executive that is directly elected. You had, on the other hand, an executive trying to represent because they need to get reelected, and a House trying to represent. That's maybe a tough sell these days, but a House trying to represent because they need to get reelected, and that battling may actually produce policy that systematically avoids moving away from what people want. I don't think it's hard to argue, so that might be a hard argument to sustain, given the current system in the U.S. I don't think it's hard to sustain this argument. It's not hard for a Canadian government to move away from public opinion. There actually is almost nothing stopping the Canadian government from moving away, in the short term, from moving away from public opinion. They may get penalized for it at election time, but in between elections, there's a lot of flexibility in a parliamentary system. As a consequence, representation of preferences should be weaker. The whole thing should look like this. Imagine there is this thing called system efficiency, and it's the reliability with which we want something, the government does that thing, we realize the government did that thing, and we don't want it anymore. That's the kind of classic Estonian version of system efficiency. And system efficiency should be highest in unitary presidential systems, holding everything else constant, and should be lowest in federal parliamentary systems. Like us, there are very few unitary presidential systems, but parliamentary federal systems is where system efficiency, the reliability with which the government does something we want them to do and we figure out that they did it and then we're happy that they did it and we don't still want it, the reliability that happens in parliamentary federal systems. And then that whole plane moves up and down with issue salience, right? So you move to an issue domain we're not paying attention to and there's no system efficiency anymore at all. Now, note that might not be a bad thing. If it's a policy domain that we're not paying attention to, then public opinion has no information for policymakers. We actually don't want policymakers to pay attention to our opinions that we don't have. I mean, the salience thing, I think, is perfectly fine. Where we have opinions, I mean, one argument for salience is most small policy domains are not salient, and as a consequence, we have no opinions, and as a consequence, there is no representation. Strictly speaking, I guess that is true. Except that we could think of it this way. There's some policy domains that we're not really paying attention to, and we're just delegating there. We're just delegating. And then there are some policy domains that we are paying attention to, and there we're not delegating, and we have opinions, and we want government to do something about that. I don't have a clock or anything. I don't know where I am time-wise. Okay, I can wrap up soon. It turns out, when you run those models with heaps of public opinion data and spending data across Canada and the US and the UK, across many different policy domains, that there is, for instance, a strong relationship between the size of the feedback coefficient and the proportion of the public that cites that policy domain as highly salient. when domains are more important to people, there is greater public feedback. I don't think that seems like, even when it's echoed to me, I don't think that seems like a major finding. Nevertheless, there it is. It seems kind of nonsensical, or at least like totally obvious when I say it out loud. But it turns out that when people pay attention to policy domains, they react to changes in government spending. And they react to changes in government spending in exactly the way they should if they were thermostats. The government does more when they want them to do more, and those people don't still want more. Ceteris paribus, right? Something else might happen, and there may be another reason for them to still want more. And we just collapse social domains together. It turns out that when feedback gets higher, representation gets higher, and these are standardized coefficients. But basically, when there are greater levels of public feedback, there are greater levels of representation. When we pay attention to what government does, and we react to what government does, governments react to what we want. And when we're not paying attention, governments don't react to what we want. And I'll just flag that not only do I care that there are dots and that they go upwards nicely, but in this context I want to particularly flag that the Canadian dots are the lowest. We exhibit in Canada, amongst these three countries at least, the lowest level of feedback and, as a consequence, the lowest level of representation. That means we exhibit the worst system efficiency. I sound very aggravated. You actually can take the coefficient from a feedback model and take the coefficient from the responsiveness model and multiply them together, and what you get is the rate at which the system self-corrects. How long does it take a system? Imagine we're just bouncing along in some state of equilibrium. And then there is some punctuation. We want $10,000, that's nothing, right? We want, I don't know, $10 million more spent on something. How long does it take on average, holding everything else constant, for a system to recognize, for a government to recognize we want that, for them to do something about it, for us to know they did something about it, and then not want it anymore? Well, these are the hypothetical trends in social policy domains based on coefficients from social policy regressions across these three countries. And what you have is a U.S. system that's right in the middle, a British unitary, during the period we're working on, a British unitary system in which system efficiency it self-corrects more quickly, and a Canadian system in which it self-corrects a little more slowly. What we're talking about is the efficiency of the thermostat. So the half-life, now how long does it take for you to correct half of the punctuation, right? The half-life of this kind of hypothetical shock in the UK is about 2 years, and the half-life of this hypothetical shock in Canada is about 4 years. It's twice as long. I think that's fascinating. I think it's fascinating for a variety of reasons, partly because 4 years is about the rate at which we expect governments to change. So there's something very interesting there going on that I haven't quite played with yet. But that's my general pitch for how we can use public opinion to understand how policy domains work and to understand how well representative democratic institutions work. And it turns out it works across countries too. When you spin it out to different countries, and here we're just using preferences for total government spending, and it's noisier for sure, but it tends to be when you get to upward, the higher up changes in spending are, the bigger shift there is in net support for more spending, so this is evidence of thermostatic responsiveness across countries. And it turns out when you run models across all those countries where what you do is allow for political institutions to moderate the impact of preferences on institutions. Systems in which there is low degree of federalism exhibit a strongly negative coefficient, as in people are responding a lot. And as we move to systems with high levels of federalism, in this case, I mean, these are ballpark estimates, in this case it's actually no longer significant, right? As this is like, if you get enough federalism, people can't respond at all anymore. That's a bit of an exaggeration. I've allowed the regression behind it to kind of float through a little bit, but we don't need to. It also turns out when you take into account executive dominance, right, which is about presidentialism versus parliamentarism, we actually allow that to interact with the number of political parties in the system as well. turns out you get the greater degrees of representation when you have a low number of political parties and low executive dominance. I feel very pro-American today. And as you add parties and as you add executive dominance, you get less representation. We're in the middle of the last column would be us, which shows no representation. But these are ballpark estimates. Right? I expect there to be a lot of noise. The point is that work on the thermostatic model makes clear that there is a kind of sensible relationship between preferences and policy. Sensible in the sense that preferences seem to change in light of policy over time, and sensible in that the differences in that thermostatic relationship seem to vary the way we should expect them across different kinds of political institutions. And all of that, I think, points to the potential value of, at least in broad categories, public opinion as an input into the policy process. That's true at least when what we're talking about our salient domains and when we're asking our broad questions. The question that I like the least, because it's come up a lot in some of the healthcare stuff I've been doing, is a question that asks people whether they think that their doctors should work in groups or independently. I don't know that. I don't think we can expect people to know that. This is too specific. We can't use public opinion to make all the small decisions that have to happen in public policy. What we can do is we can use public opinion to get at some of the big stuff. What we should be using public opinion for in the healthcare domain is, are you happy with the existing system? Do you think that the system is likely to remain like this? Or what are your main concerns in the way in which the system might change? And this is what I like about using the thermostatic model as a lead-in to opinion and policy, we can use opinion over time to see if changes we make to the healthcare system find their way into public opinion, to see whether people are happier with the healthcare system now than they were 4 years ago. That, for me, is the real value of public opinion, more in policy evaluation than in this kind of micro level, I'm going to say, policy design. So that's all, I guess, fine. There is one additional problem. The additional problem is that we are now in a fiscal and political climate in which there just is much less investment in public opinion polling. And so this is just Health Canada, because this is directly from a report I had on hand. But you can actually go to the Public Works and Government Services website. You can look at how many, they keep track of all the polls annually. Now, it might just be that polls are being moved into the PMO or something, or to the party, let's say. And so maybe that there are a bunch of polls being done that way. It doesn't seem that way. And certainly at the department level, there's just a lot less polling going on. And a lot of these polls were probably useful in terms of policy evaluation. I'm not going to argue that every poll was useful in policy evaluation. But there's just a lot less data. And one of the consequences is of a shift in a government's approach to polling is not just that there are a few government polls, but that there exists no omnibus telephone poll in the country anymore, right? The kind of monthly polls that used to be rolled out, or at least quarterly polls that used to be rolled out, Environics Focus Canada, Decima Quarterly, whatever the Ipsos one was, so on and so forth. There are some online versions of these that still exist, but there is no nationally representative poll anymore. So that means that a lot less data, but it also means that a lot of have a lot less data, and I think that's potentially problematic. I think it's potentially problematic because I think, and this is my last slide, I promise, I think that policy can be a really useful tool in the, public opinion, that is, can be a really useful tool in the analysis of public policy, but also in understanding the effects of institutional design. And in Canada, we should be particularly concerned about this because, as you have seen, provided you believe it, at least amongst Anglo-American democracies, Canada may actually be in real trouble. It's not that we have a non-functioning democracy. We have a functioning democracy. But the connection between opinion and policy in Canada, in most domains, is weaker than it would be in the US or the UK. You can argue that could be a good thing. Probably it's not a good thing. I think a major function if not the main function of representative democracy, is to facilitate this relationship between public opinion and policy. And that's one area in which Canada may be doing particularly badly. Stop there.
Great, thank you, Mr.